This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Russian President Vladimir Putin turned 58, 12 female admirers published a calendar of themselves in clothing and poses that could have been found in a Victoria's Secret catalog. How about a third time, read Miss February's caption, a provocative reference to Putin's third presidential run. The well-publicized gift reinforced Putin's magnetic machismo, carefully cultivated through images of the Russian leader subduing wild animals, playing rough sports, fighting fires, and many, many photos of his muscular torso on display. Political scientist Valerie Sperling makes the case that trading on widely familiar ideas about gender and sexuality has been a strategy for Putin to establish political legitimacy. This sexualization of the political realm runs parallel to increasing authoritarianism and nationalism in Russia, which includes oppression of feminists, the LGBT community, and other anti-Kremlin opposition. Valerie Sperling is professor of political science at Clark University and author of the new book, Sex, Politics, and Putin, Political Legitimacy in Russia. And Valerie Sperling, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you point to Putin's displays of masculinity with journalists in tow as part of a strategy of legitimation. Now, why do these images in particular work in today's Russia?
You know, I think this works in today's Russia. I think it resonates with the public because of the political context. You know, you have to remember that Putin comes to power right after the 1990s, and that's when you have the collapse of the Soviet Union, the loss of Russia's superpower status, the loss of communist ideology to the extent that anybody still believed in it. You have the economic collapse after the transition, you know, from communism to capitalism. And Yeltsin, during the 90s, Russia's leader, is seen as having presided over weakening Russia at the hands of the West. So in that context, right, Putin's assertion of masculinity, here we have a strong leader who's going to make Russia strong, he's going to actually re-masculinize Russia, that image, I think, really resonates. Mm-hmm.
You can't kick Russia around anymore, kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
There are many things at work here, including the significance of showing his dominance over other men. Now, Valerie, mm-hmm. is this clear that this is all strategic, or is this just who Putin is, a macho guy?
Yeah. I think most politics is about competition, and so it's going to entail dominating others. And so in that sense, these are strategic choices. It's a choice to put other potential competitors in their place. And sometimes that takes a concrete form. I can give you one example. It's kind of a graphic example. This was a few years ago. A liberal politician, Boris Nemtsov, who was jailed after participating in a protest against the regime in an opposition rally. And then while he was in jail, a pro-Putin youth group, you know, which is at least in some ways sponsored by the Kremlin, right? It went out in Moscow with a petition asking people to have the prosecutor's office investigate charges that Nemtsov had been raped while he was in jail. Right. So no, there was no evidence that Nemtsov had been raped in jail or that he had been sexually abused in any way. But what that did was it suggested, right, that maybe Nemtsov hadn't been strong enough to fend off an attack, you know, not manly enough to resist, or maybe even that he had been a willing participant in gay sex, right? So that is how that dominance can play out in this way of impugning, you know, another man's manly reputation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nashi, one of these pro-Putin groups, is also behind a video that went hyper-viral in Russia in 2011. We'll play a clip from it. It's a 2011 video, 2.5 million hits. And the announcement here is that I'll rip it for Putin. It's announcing a contest.
Достойный политик и шикарный мужчина. Он Владимир Путин. Его обожают миллионы, ему верят. Но есть кучка людей, которые поливают его грязью. Может?
So, Valerie, what's going on in this video?
So in this video, you see this very nicely dressed young woman in stiletto heels, very buxom as well, strolling around in chic areas of Moscow with her iPhone. And what she's doing in the clip, the voiceover that you hear, she's talking about what a wonderful politician and man Putin is. So she goes on like this. She meets up with some of her young, beautiful friends, and they announce a competition called I'll Rip for Putin. And at the end of the clip, what she does, she has a tank top, a white tank top that she's wearing, and she tears it in half. And the clip ends just as she tears it, so you don't actually get to see anything. And at that last moment, the voiceover says, and it's her voice speaking, she says, what are you prepared to do for your president?
But opposition groups have been vocal, but I'd like to know how vocal. Is there a politically legitimate feminist voice or party in Russian politics today, and how do they regard Putin?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is definitely a feminist voice in Russia today, but it's a small voice in public. I think that the young feminists that I interviewed, they see Putin and the whole masculinity macho strategy for exactly what it is. Like, he's being portrayed as the alpha male whose leadership can't be questioned. You know, so in other words, they see that machismo and authoritarianism are reinforcing each other. And also, to the extent that the political leader in that paradigm has to be defined as a manly man, that doesn't leave a lot of room in politics for women. And feminists recognize that as well.
Well, there was one opposition group that we heard a lot about, reached international attention. This is the punk rock performance artist group, Pussy Riot. Members were arrested a few minutes into performing this punk prayer. Now, this was at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, later sentenced to prison and later did a bit of a PR run around the United States. Here's just a little clip of the chaos from this original video. They're in dresses and masks and they're chanting and dancing and genuflecting on the altar. In the book, you analyze some of Pussy Riot's songs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the lyrics are trading on those same kind of macho images, like they're calling Putin a pansy or, you know, saying that he wets himself, you know, that kind of thing. So reinforcing all of these gender norms. And they're not the only opposition groups to suggest that Putin, you know, maybe not manly enough. Mm-hmm. Their anti-Kremlin activists in Russia have marched under a banner that Putin is a faggot. And I'm sorry to use that word, but so when did this sexuality become a rallying cry in Russian politics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it happens actually in the 1990s, and it's not before that, because in the communist era, there's none of that. You know, politicians didn't have to be advertised to the public. But in the 90s, after the Soviet Union collapses and Russia becomes an independent state, that's when you start to see some sexuality getting mixed up in politics. But at that time, it's absolutely on the margins. And specifically, it's embodied in this one Russian politician, this very kind of clownish, over-the-top politician named Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Now, he had a party which continues to exist called the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia. But anyway, he ran, Zhirinovsky ran for president in 1996 against Yeltsin. And that's where he started bringing in the sexuality. He said, the LDPR is a virgin party. And on election day, 40 million men are going to race after the virgin LDPR. And all the other parties are political prostitutes. So at that time, you know, I think he was widely recognized as being a marginal character. But anyway, after Putin came to power, though, sexuality, masculinity, desirability, those things became harnessed to the political prospects of Putin, who was a comparatively staid, you know, mainstream politician. I think that's when it really starts to get big.
Google Vladimir Putin and you're bound to come up with loads of images of the shirtless Russian leader. Well, we're talking with the political scientist Valerie Sperling, who's done a lot of research on gender norms and the political realm in Russia. Her new book is called Sex, Politics, and Putin. So at the same time that Putin's been kind of pushing this masculinity and its association with being a strong, decisive leader, Russia was becoming a less democratic state, which leads us to one of the major lines of inquiry in your study, that role that sexuality in the political realm plays in democracy. I know it's tough to summarize, but how do you see that fitting in?
Well, I guess we could look at this question in one of two ways. One is, what does using so many gender norms and sexualization do to democracy? In other words, how does it undermine democracy? And the other way to look at it is that this is something that's not unique to Russia, that it enters into other dictatorships, and it also enters into democracies. A difference is that in democracies, right, in places that have a longstanding women's movement, it's not as easy for politicians to succeed on that basis. The United States, even, when Todd Akin in 2012 was running for the Senate, right, the Republican, and he made that awful comment that legitimate rape, you know, would not result in pregnancy, mm-hmm. he lost his race mm-hmm. because I think the public was well aware that that was not a legitimate thing to say. And by contrast, in 2006, when Putin was speaking to Israel's prime minister, a statement was made which caught the attention of Russian feminists, but they were not really able to bring it to the public's attention. What happened was, at that time, Israel's president had been accused of raping two of the women on his staff. And Putin, he said, oh, President Kotsov turned out to be a mighty man. He raped 10 women. You know, we all envy him. And apparently, like both delegations, you know, laughed at this rape joke. And so this was reported, feminists knew about it, but it didn't get any traction as a shameful story in Russia, the way that I suspect something like that would get traction if there was a bigger, stronger feminist movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, now Russia is largely diplomatically isolated. Inflation, low gas prices are really sending the economy into the tank. Will we see more of these displays of machismo, you know, the shirtless, decisive Putin that you can rally behind? Does it work anymore?
I think it does continue to work. The worse Russia's position gets, in a way, the stronger Putin's position gets personally. The more endangered Russia is, whether it's being threatened, you know, from the West, you know, with sanctions, trying to undermine Russia, I think the more the Russian regime can point to that, the more they can point to the necessity of Putin as the leader. You know, speaking about sexual metaphors and, you know, and so forth, a couple of weeks ago, Boris Nemtsov, a liberal politician, he was being asked, I think, how is Putin managing to be so popular, even despite, you know, the ruble crashing and the economy being in some dire straits? You know, Putin's still pulling something over 80% approval ratings. And Nemtsov said, using a very sexual metaphor, he said, by taking over the Crimea, Putin found the Russian population's G-spot, and they are prepared to forgive him everything.
Well, I think we have to end there. Valerie Sperling, professor of political science at Clark University and author of the new book, Sex, Politics, and Putin, Political Legitimacy in Russia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It was a real pleasure, Virginia.
Now, you'll find more on the book and you can see some of the many shirtless Putin tumblers. We've got links at wordofmouthradio.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, this song is about a man I really like. He's so cute, he's so strong and so powerful. This song is about
Vladimir
Putin. Vladimir
Putin.
Forget the days of Magnum PI and Hasselhoff. When it comes to the masculine ideal on television today, Mad Men's dapper and enigmatic Don Draper takes the cake. Up next, why a fictional whiskey-drinking philanderer from the 1960s has become a new masculine icon. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While a shirtless Vladimir Putin signals strength and virility in Russia, here in the U.S., millennial television viewers have been taken in by a different depiction of manhood. For them, Don Draper, the fictional character played by John Hamm in AMC's Mad Men, is the new epitome of masculinity. He's powerful, well-dressed, promiscuous, and enigmatic. Eric Malinsky tries to understand why fans of the show are ready to ditch their T-shirts and jeans for slim-cut suits and ties.
So I was talking to this guy at a bar, Neil Scapora. He's from the Bay Area. He says dude all the time. But when Neil watches the show Mad Men, he wishes he could wear his suit to work.
Dude, I don't have the function for it. That's the bummer. In California, so few people really have a calling to actually wear a formalized suit.
Neil's being modest. His boss instituted a dress code for the whole office just because Neil wore shabby T-shirts. He started wearing collared shirts, but they're always a little subversive, like a rat instead of an alligator. I asked him what would happen if Don Draper was his boss.
He probably would have beaten me in the alley. I would have been like an affront to his manhood. He probably would have just pummeled me with his chin for a while.
Hey, Don, look who's here.
It isn't the man in the gray flannel suit.
What the hell is that for?
Don Draper is nothing like me either. He's reserved while I'm effusive. He's formal. I'm casual. He erased his childhood. I still have my Star Wars action figures. But I also wish I could be more like him. I even started consulting a blog called What Would Don Draper Do?
Well, you'd want advice from this man who seems anointed.
Michael Dempster created the blog. It's a side project. In his day job, he writes for Howard Stern, who is about as far from Don Draper as you can get.
Yeah, my first impulse is always to make a joke about f***ing or, you know, transsexuals or something, but never to shut my mouth.
The blog is a lot cleaner. It works more like a Dear Abby column. For instance, someone wrote, Dear Don, I'm considering a long-distance relationship with someone who lives across the country. She's fantastic, but is it worth the distance and expense? Dempster does his best to channel Don Draper.
I like the idea of entering into any relationship with an assumed distance. A comfortable remove is a wise position. Long sounds too far for comfort.
It's interesting the way you like furrow your brow.
Well, I squint a little bit, but yeah, it's a very sober attitude that he has, even though he's not really ever sober.
Matt Caldicott is another Don Draper fan. He's jealous of Don's sense of privacy, something we've lost today.
There isn't much mystery in this day and age. I mean, most people can find out just about anything about you by going on Google.
Matt works in Spin, doing PR for internet companies. He says today, there's no way Don could be so secretive and maintain a professional reputation.
He would have to be out all the time. He would have to be on Twitter commenting on industry trends and issues. He'd have to do all sorts of things that, you know, going to sit in a bar after work just really wouldn't do for him.
I asked each of these guys what was the coolest thing Draper ever did. It wasn't the philandering, because we see how destructive that is to his family. It wasn't even the drinking and smoking at the office. It was the fact that at the end of season two, Don went on this business trip to California and disappeared for 3 weeks.
Mr. Draper, you're a sight for sore eyes.
Hello, Joan. It's good to be back.
Do you want to know if you've been missed? That's half your correspondence. Mr. Sterling has been very anxious to speak to you on a daily basis.
Call Roger in a half an hour and tell him I'll meet him in a half an hour. And Mr. Phillips, maybe I'll run into him in the men's room.
I mean, I know of situations where people are actually sending emails that basically say things to the effect of whereabouts. I can't imagine Don sitting down at his desk, sending out a one-line email saying, going to the movies for 3 hours this afternoon. Be back sometime before 5.
I think you're not suited for this job.
What did I do?
In addition to being incompetent, you threatened my reputation, and not just today.
Mr. Draper, I try to cover for you all the time.
You do not cover for me. You manage people's expectations.
Is this not the whitest TV show you've ever seen? You know, there are some massive changes in the workplace of today that are not ever likely to be repeated.
Michael Kimball is a sociologist. He doesn't think that fans of the show want to go back to a time when white men held power through racism or sexism. But those of us born after 1970 are seeing something very appealing in the workplace of the early 60s. In Don Draper's world, security, status, and stability are easy to obtain. If Don wants to, he could stay at Sterling Cooper for his entire career.
The guys in Mad Men, you know, they have an idea of what they want by the time they're 30, by the time they're 40. And you could ask them. And, you know, Seth Rogen, he can't tell you where he's going to be next week.
You know, the web page or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
So how do you...
How do I pay rent? When I was in high school, I got ran over by a postal truck. I got like 14 grand.
Kimmel interviewed hundreds of young men for his book, Guyland. They're a lot like Judd Apatow characters. They have big dreams to be a filmmaker or an internet mogul, but they're just not sure how to get there.
The economy is so, it makes you so anxious. It's so tenuous. Any hold you might have can be taken away in an instant.
So they go from job to job, waiting for their big break. They're not boys anymore, but they'll never be men in gray flannel suits.
They're living with a level of anxiety that Don Draper never had to face. That's an infantilizing situation. That is, we're putting them in a situation where it's hard to be grown-ups, and then we're saying, okay, be grown-ups.
Banana Republic now sells Mad Men-style suits. Maybe if guys like me dress like Don Draper, we can feel more like grown-ups. But the great thing about Don Draper is that he secretly wants to escape from his suit. That's why we like him.
If I leave this place, it will not be for more advertising.
What else is there?
I don't know, life being lived.
And our thanks to producer Eric Malinsky for that story. Well, heavy smoking and drinking seem to be the key to Don Draper's physique. Today's dandies might just consider hitting the gym. But what if you just can't get yourself to work out? Up next, a philosopher shares some ideas on how to think about exercise in order to maintain a regimen. That's coming up after the news when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're not too far into the new year yet, so many of the people who resolved to get more exercise in 2015 are likely still sticking it out at the gym. Not to dim hopes, but statistically, less than 10% of weight loss resolutions will last. Damon Young is an honorary fellow in philosophy at the University of Melbourne. His latest book is called How to Think About Exercise. It won't offer tips for getting perfect abs or teach you how to run a 5-minute mile, but it may just help your resolutions stick. How to Think About Exercise is part of the School of Life series, and a pleasure to have you with us, Damon. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a philosophy book about exercise, which sounds a little bit like an oxymoron. Is that the point?
Yes, in part. In fact, I wrote the book partly because people were so surprised that I, as a philosopher, would exercise, that I'd be, you know, swinging kettlebells or indoor rock climbing or, you know, punching on with a friend in the backyard doing karate. And I realized that there was some strange divide in people's minds, that they thought that if you were an intellectual person, a bookish person, a curious person, then for some reason you wouldn't be interested in sport or exercise or fitness, that is, that you were kind of disembodied. And I wanted to explore that a little further because I got the feeling that it was exiling some people from the commonwealth of the body.
Well, talk to me more about that divide, this kind of dualism of mind and body. How does that manifest?
Well, it's often the idea that, for example, someone who is a sports person must be an idiot. So there was a wonderful caricature played by Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading, the Coen Brothers film. He's just the beautiful, stereotypical jock, just kind of positive thinking mantras and oiled muscles, but he's as dense as a bag of stones. And this trope, this kind of metaphor, permeates our culture, and it's basically the idea that there are two realms in the world. There's a realm of mind, of the soul, of spirit, of thought, and then there's a realm of bodies, flesh, carnality. And you get the sense that some people think of their bodies just as kind of machines that need to be tinkered with. So you go to the gym, you do your reps. It adds nothing to your intellectual life, your emotional life at all. It's just about kind of tuning up that body. And what happens is it's dull, it's boring, it adds nothing to their life, they leave. What I'm suggesting in the book is that there are all kinds of enhancements to the intellect and enrichments to character and the imagination that you can get through your body. So you have to kind of bring your mind and your body together mindfully.
Let's hear just a clip from that Coen Brothers film. Chad is the name of the character you're describing, a sort of gum-smacking personal trainer. Let's hear it.
The quality of the intelligence dictates how high up he is, okay. Not what we know. I also... Do you have any water? I gotta hydrate.
I got tap water.
Are you kidding?
How do you know who he is?
Sources.
What do you mean, sources?
You got like Gatorade or anything besides like Maryland swamp water? Do you know how far this is from my...
How do you know his name?
So you're talking about integrating the thinking person and the athletic, the workout person, you know, the kind of philosopher athlete, which sounds to me kind of Greek. Is there a philosophical basis in this?
Yes, there is. What I do in the book is I go back to the Greeks, back to Socrates, for example. He was, of course, the teacher of Plato. Plato was the teacher of Aristotle. So these are the beginnings. And interestingly, in the dialogues of one historian and general, Xenophon, we find Socrates talking about the intellectual importance of the body. And there's another theme in the Greeks too, which I talk about, and it comes out in the Iliad. There's a running race in the Iliad where Odysseus beats Ajax. Mm-hmm. He basically wins by cheating. A god comes down and helps. But to the Greeks who are watching, it doesn't matter because it's an awesome thing to see people strive and compete and win. And what I'm suggesting is that we've often lost a sense that pride through your body is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with taking pleasure in yourself. Now, that might be the pleasure of running up a hill. It might be the pleasure of rock climbing. It might be the sublime sense of swimming. You don't have to get some kind of personal best to do this. You don't have to beat someone else. And you don't have to get an Olympian's body.
But let's go a little further with the pride, which can sometimes cross over into a kind of narcissism. At one point in the book, you advise people to look at themselves in the mirror naked and experiment with different poses. Okay, that could be self-torture for some of us, or it could be a kind of, I don't know, narcissism, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's right. First of all, what I'm doing with that mirror is to get used to the way our self-esteem, our sense of our own beauty or glory is often dependent on our ideas of others. So that if you look at yourself naked and imagine someone who is an Olympic athlete, you're going to feel bad about yourself. And then if you imagine someone who is less fit than you, who might be softer than you, you might feel better about yourself. It's showing the arbitrariness of a lot of these feelings. But the second thing is when it comes to narcissism, yes, this is a very real danger. And there are some correlations with some power sports and weightlifting. But I'm suggesting that an interest in the way you look is not a bad thing, as long as you recognize that it's just the way you look. So I talk about the thrill that we get as humans from looking at new unities, harmonies, and forms in our bodies. It really is a thrill to watch new muscle groups coming out, the relationships, the proportions in our bodies. The problem is when we think that these muscular groups say anything else about us. They don't make us a better person. They don't make us more deserving of respect or sexual glory. They are simply a muscular development.
Pride is one of the virtues of exercise, with benefits that aren't always directly related to health. But one of the virtues you write about is a harder sell, and that is pain. You know, for those of us who do not have a god to come down and help us, isn't that why so many of us avoid working out, this fear of pain?
There's a scene in Roadhouse where Patrick Swayze is being sewn up without anesthetic.
I just can't believe you're quoting Roadhouse now.
And Swayze turns to this doctor and says, "Pain don't hurt." Now, it sounds glib and a little bit ludicrous, but in fact, he's right. There is evidence to show that the way we think about pain and the meaning of the situation changes how we feel that pain. Getting crunched in the abdomen when I'm doing martial arts and getting crunched when I trip over my son's Lego and fall on a couch, both of which have happened, feel the same. It's the same impact on my body. In the case of tripping over and hitting my side, I'm furious, I'm angry, I'm ranting, "You need to clean up your Lego." When it comes to martial arts, it's all just part of the fight. In fact, there's something bracing and invigorating about that very same strike. I'm not angry at my friend for punching me. I'm not saying that exercise won't hurt. It will hurt. What I'm suggesting is that when it's part of a meaningful activity that we are committed to, pain is less of a problem, and we may, in fact, welcome that pain as a sign that we are striving.
Because you are talking about integrating mind and body, yeah? And a lot of people, when they're working out, they try to keep themselves distracted. You know, they watch television maybe in the gym, or they listen to music with their earbuds in. You're not such a fan of that. Why?
I'm not. I don't mind it at the gym. I think gyms can be quite sterile places. So if you're on a treadmill or you're on a stationary bike, you know, it might be fantastic to listen to a podcast or some stimulating music. But what I'm suggesting in the book, partly inspired by Charles Darwin, is that when you go for a walk or a run, you might want to actually engage your senses and allow the reverie that arises when you walk and run to be engaged with the stimulating world at a human pace. Because a lot of the time, we're speeding around our neighborhoods or around the city behind glass, you know, at 55 miles an hour. We're not engaging with our world. Stop. Take the time. See what's around you. You'd be surprised what you find.
We're talking with Damon Young. He's a philosopher and author of How to Think About Exercise. It's a new volume from the smartest self-help series / most accessible philosophy series I've yet come across, The School of Life. Damon, who's this book for, though? I can imagine the soft intellectuals and armchair philosophers, because it doesn't really seem like the kind of thing you'd find in the stack of, you know, Shape magazine or Men's Health magazines at Gold's Gym.
Okay, I think there are a few audiences for this. The first are people who have defined themselves against the body, against fitness, against exercise, because they see these things as kind of annexed by jocks, by thugs. And so they're alienated from the fitness industry and often from their own bodies. Then there's another group of people who do go to the gym, who are interesting, curious, you know, bookish people. They have a rich intellectual life. But when they go to the gym, they switch their minds off. Now, for some people, this is fantastic. They've used their brain all day. They don't want to do it anymore. But there are a lot of people who give up at the gym, partly out of the banality of it all. Mm-hmm. These are people who want mental stimulation. They crave good conversation. They're interested in rich ideas and impressions. But when they go to the gym, that all stops. So what I'm suggesting is they need to remind themselves that there is the sublime in swimming. There is aesthetic richness in doing weights. There is pride in sprinting and reverie in running and so on. Then I think there's one last group. And these are the people who are outstanding athletes who are looking to broaden their intellectual life. These are the Chads from Burn After Reading of the World, who everyone's just said, "Man, you are so buff, you are swole, man." But what about their ideas about art or music or ethics? So these people need to be given the chance to enrich their minds.
So for all of those people who profess to want to exercise but complain that they just don't have the time, maybe they are making intellectual pursuits, do you think that's a legitimate argument?
It's certainly true that it is difficult to find the time, you know, if you work, particularly if you have children or you're studying. The first thing is to realize that physical striving is no less important than having a job. You are a body. You live through your body. Why not engage it thoughtfully. But secondly, you don't have to go to the gym. I know that if I had to go to the gym to work out, I would not work out. This is partly because gyms are expensive, but it's also because I know I'd have to stop what I'm doing, get in the car, drive to some place, change my uniform, engage in banter with people I may not like, and so on. I'm revealing a little bit more about my personality here. A lot of my exercises are solitary. You'll pick that up in the book. So a lot of the exercise I do is from home. I run around my own neighborhood. I do chin-ups and push-ups in my own home. I have kettlebells in the garage. So what I've done is I've integrated exercise into my daily routines. So it doesn't have to be something special. It's just something I do. Another way is to see obstacles as opportunities. Now, I know that sounds like a horrible self-help tagline. You've not failed. You've just missed a chance for greatness. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm suggesting is, take the stairs in buildings and railways. It may be exhausting at first, but you'll feel awesome afterwards. If you're taking public transport, stop a couple of stops before when you get off and then walk the rest of the way.
Well, Damon, if we rewound the clock, I guess a week or so ago, is there an exercise resolution that you would suggest to replace the more generic, I'm going to go to the gym 3 times a week, or, I want to lose 15 pounds? What would be a better resolution?
My resolution would be exercise as a whole person rather than just a mechanical body. So if you want to see yourself enjoying exercise for the whole of your life, rather than for the next 6 months, try to imagine those things that will keep you stimulated over the decades, not just the weeks. So that's not just going to be your personal best or sort of rock hard Olympian abs, because you're probably not going to get those. And it's fine to be realistic about that. Instead, what is going to stimulate your imagination? What is going to sharpen your intellect? What is going to give you a sense of pride? These are the things that keep people motivated over the years, not necessarily whether they can get a movie star body.
Damon Young, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Damon Young is Honorary Fellow in Philosophy at the University of Melbourne. He's author of several books, including How to Think About Exercise, a book from the School of Life series. You'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Sunday mornings in the Castro neighborhood of San Francisco, a group of dance students have found a way to get into shape and enjoy the benefits of playing the part of a sassy backup dancer for a day. While leg warmers, spandex, and fluorescent headbands are not required, many of the students find that their fashion choices help them get into character. Producer David Boyer takes us to the Sunday School.
All right, let's get started. I hear people coming up the stairs. Good morning, Beatrice.
A couple dozen people gather at the Academy of Ballet. It's early, 11 a.m., and while it looks like your standard dance studio, there's wall-to-wall mirrors up front and ballet bars in the back, it's clear this is not your average dance class. For starters, there's the students.
We have people who are 60.
Doctors.
People who are obese.
Drag queens.
People who've had HIV for decades.
And then there's folks like this.
I write software which helps manage the logistics at ports.
And this.
I teach AP Calculus and Algebra 2 and Algebra 1.
And this.
I work at a really vanilla job. We actually specialize in investment management.
On the surface, they all have something in common.
I work at a place that's pretty stodgy.
And that's one of the reasons they've come here today.
It's fun to be able to just dress up one day a week at least and live the dream.
The dream is backup dancing, and their dream maker is Darcy Drollinger. You can't miss him. He's leading the warm-up in fluorescent blue spandex with hot pink socks and a headband.
I personally have a spandex addiction.
Many people here have clearly followed his lead.
I am wearing star-studded fishnet stockings with sparkly panties.
A Hanes t-shirt with hand-stenciled lettering that says, I'm a stupid bitch. A
lot of good gold lamé.
Skimpy tops.
Leopard print booty shorts.
Neon colors.
A cut-off shirt with my hairy little gut sticking out.
Fringe.
And I'm fine if people come in gym shorts and a t-shirt. But if they put on a sassy flash dance top and some leg warmers, I can guarantee you they're going to dance harder and they're going to have more fun.
But don't be fooled by the outfits. This class is physically challenging and this warm-up is no joke.
And stretch. Flap back. Plie stretch. Flap back. Release sideline.
I'm not kidding. The first time I went, I could not really walk that well till Thursday.
After the class, I told Darcy, I said, oh my gosh, I can't do this. He just said, come back next week. Just keep coming back. And I did. And it got easier.
This is week 3 of this routine, so I'm going to push you a little further. And I tightened up a few things too, so you'll be happy.
Squeeze me.
The dance moves, honey. The dance moves.
So here's how it works. Darcy creates a new routine each month. He teaches it in bite-sized sections, adding new bits each week.
This little beginning part's the most complicated part of the whole thing, so once we get that under our belt, we can keep running that over and over and over, and we'll add the rest of it. And I'll put some music on, and we'll start working with music. 5, 6, 7, 8. Face, 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 shoulder, smooth skin, palm, palm.
Okay. Darcy demonstrates as he goes. The laser-focused students watch him in the mirror and mimic his every move. Some nail it. There's also some awkwardness. And there's a few questions. Once everybody's got it, Darcy moves on.
Boom. And I'm about to show you something gorgeous. Okay. Turn around. Boom. One. Push it out. Bring it in. Show it off. And bam. More. And bam. Hello. Whip it. All right. Let's try it with some music.
It's not about getting every move right every single time.
I want to see a little fire in your faces.
He pushes us to have an attitude, to be fierce.
Give me something. Sell the song to me.
It's kind of like half acting and half dancing.
You got no excuse but to seduce. 6, 7, 8.
He will often say in class,
I want sexy.
Give me sexy.
Or I want attitude.
Or give me attitude. I choose attitude over sexy. The sexy thing is still so tied up with my Catholic upbringing that sexy meant slutty.
Some of them are going to be better at tossing their hair. Some people are going to be better at, you know, the actual move. Some people are going to be better at crawling on the floor, whatever it is. You know what I mean? So using whatever strength they have.
Definitely feel glamorous. Definitely feel fabulous.
I want you to fire every muscle.
For some, muscle. Sunday school is a great way to unwind and get some exercise. But for many, the class is much more.
The class has definitely changed my life. I think I struggle with not being comfortable in my own skin. And I know this sounds kind of cliche, but he's kind of taught me how to love myself. To love who I am, to embrace who I am, and to show off who I am.
I would go crazy if I didn't get to dance. Don't get to have that type of expression anywhere else.
It seems like a lot of people in class have gotten up the courage to quit their crappy jobs after being in dance class for a while. You feel almost rebellious, and you begin to get more impatient with things that don't make you feel positive about yourself. I think I understand more now why people go to church.
And for Darcy, their passion is his reward.
What is so satisfying is to watch these people when they give it their all. They give it everything they've got, and they may not be perfect, and they're probably not going to be perfect. But there's something so joyous when they are going for it in this kind of raw, enthusiastic way, purely for the joy of doing it.
You're fabulous. Have a wonderful week. I love you all. Thank you.
And that story came to us from producer David Boyer. Thanks so much for listening today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org or on the NHPR app. Earlier in the program, we talked to a philosopher about how to rethink one of the most popular New Year's resolutions, getting in shape, and why it's so difficult to maintain an exercise regimen. We'd like to hear from you. Do you have that dualistic thinking that you're either an intellectual or a jock? Are you among the 10% of people who's actually stuck to their New Year's resolution to exercise more? Or do you find it hard to maintain? Do you dread hitting the treadmill? What types of activities get you out the door or on the mat? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. You never know what kind of exercise inspiration you might find via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.